accession number 10262, reel 1 of 2.
Mr. Bates, Reel 1. So could I ask you first of all, Mr. Bates, about your life before the war started? Whereabouts would you have been living?
Manchester.
And could you tell me something about your family? You know, the sort of family you came from?
Well, yes, but to my own knowledge of my family, you see, I was the last one. I was the last child. And my father and mother died in 1915. 12 months before I joined the Flying Corps. So I don't know much about them, really, only up to that time schooling. And a couple of years apprentice plumber, that's all. Is this going on now?
Yes. Do you remember the outbreak of war?
Yeah, 1914, yes.
Yeah. How old would you have been then?
Well, I was 19 in 1916. 17.
Do you remember how you reacted? What, you know, was there, was it a surprise to begin with?
Well, it not so much a surprise because we didn't know anything about it, did it? It was so quick. But everything changed as soon as the declaration of war came out. And all the people called up, the Red Territory and everything was called up and all that, and we were all hustle and bustle straight away. We had called all the horses who could get together to take, you know, to go over to the war service and everything. And everything, more or less, everything didn't actually stop. But you understand what I mean? It was made up, they muddled it all up and had to get something else to take place of what they was taking away.
How did you yourself react? You know, did you want to join up at that
well,
time?
Well, I wasn't old enough. I didn't bother. It didn't enter my mind to do so. Not at 17. And I was apprentice plumber, you see. And in my spare time, I was learning cinema operating. I was a part-time operator at the local cinema. So, of course, my time was full up. I'd be all day and night. I went to work in the morning at 8 o'clock and I didn't finish till about 11 at night on the cinema. As far as that goes. So I didn't know much, really. And then, of course, in those days, we weren't the same as they are today, children. Quite different. And one of Thomas, some of my apprenticeship was a plumber, and I first of all went to electricians, I think. Do you want all this? I first of all went to be trained for an electrician. But all I did was push an handcart about all day. So my mother stopped me doing that. She said, you're not doing that all day long. She said, that's how they learn. You can't learn much. That's how they teach. You can't learn much. So anyway, she changed me over and signed me up to this plumber and decorator, for 7 years. So I had to stop there. And of course, 1916, I joined the Flying Corps because if I hadn't joined voluntarily, I should have been a conscript. And I didn't want to be a conscript. For one thing, I wanted to choose my own regiment. Luckily, my sister, who's down, I think she's 96 now, I'm not sure. She's still alive in America. She's in America now. Been there since 1922 when I first came out of the Flying Corps. And her friend's husband was Chief Inspector of Manchester, Police in Manchester. And during the DORA, was it? What was it called now? Lighting, all that lighting in the wartime. He couldn't have lights here and there, and he was in charge of all that. So I don't know, they must have said something between themselves, and suppose she said I was due for enlistment if I was conscripted or voluntary. Anyway, he said, send him down to the police station where he was in Manchester, his police station. He said, I'll see what the Flying Corps recruiting officer will say. So I went down there and put me in straight away.
Did you yourself want to go into the Flying Corps?
Well, I didn't mind anything being. I'd not give it no thought until then, you see, because it gives nothing to worry about, really, because I hadn't got to go until conscription, but I didn't want to be conscripted. And I didn't mind going into the Flying Corps, and I'm glad I did go. It was was about the best regiment in the British Army, I think, I found out during my service in it. I don't mean the Air Force, I mean the Flying Corps.
Yes. Could you tell me now about the procedure for joining the Flying Corps? Did you have to have a medical?
Oh, well, you have to.
Did they give you a medical?
Not then. Trade test then, not a medical. A test of trade, you see. Could you go? You went in the Flying Corps as a tradesman in those days. But if you were going to learn flying, you had to volunteer. You couldn't make it fly. You just volunteered, if you fancied it, you volunteered and you went through the training and there you are. But you went in as a tradesman. But I went in as a coppersmith, sheet metal worker and a coppersmith. Being a plumber, you seemed the same, almost the same work. And then that was the day I joined. I had to have a test. And all they do then is recruit not so good. They said, well, right, meet me at Bonner Road Station, 11 o'clock tonight. Send me to go straight down to Farnborough. And I would have cracked surprised how many were there when I got there that night. There was, well, nearly a train, I think half a train full going down to Farnborough. You know, I just joined that day. And we stayed in Farnborough. Oh, well, not for long, because that's what they call the recruit step off. It was then in those days, in Farnborough. And didn't do much training there, because it was just all recruits coming and going out, you see. Coming in for a few days, getting a uniform, and getting used to the, I suppose, the dealing with the... It's quite different to civilian life when you get to this, that sort of life. And eventually I got moved over to with Samoa and to... where did I go first of all? Netherhaven or somewhere like that.
Netherhaven
or Uphaven in Hampshire. I'm not quite sure which one it was, but one of them. And we stayed there on for some time on teaching... logging pilots that were learning. They come from all over the world learning there, surprisingly. They've got volunteers, all branches of army and all over the place. India, Africa and everywhere they come from, the officers. Because it was mostly officers, you see, that were training then. And what we're doing, they were just booking the times of what they were doing and asking what they'd been doing when they were flying, you know, when they were up in the air. And they'd tell you, give me an idea what you're doing, so you book it down. And that's all we used to do then, apart from fatigue work and all that. Until I got moved to... you have to remember where you're going, you see. It's a long time ago. Where are they going there? Uphaven. They put me in a squadron. I can't move, can I? I was at Gosport for some time. Just training, that's all. Doing this ordinary flying corps training. We didn't do army training, you know, no rifles and all that. Wear revolvers, not rifles. And didn't do any soldiering like that. All we used to do was first thing in the morning, physical exercises. And then we'd have to go out marching, that sort of thing, you know, for the part of the day. Then the rest of the day was our own, unless you was on fatigue. And then you had to work all day. But... I got up to the time now, because that's all we were doing, really, until I went to France.
Yes,
and that was in 90, that was 2 years.
Yes, were you actually working with the planes?
Well, I wasn't on the plane, because I was a workshop man, you see. Fitters and riggers were on the planes.
Yes, so what were you yourself doing in the workshop? What was your work?
Well, I wanted any copper work that wanted doing, you know, with anybody else was there, and that sort of thing. Brazing, most of it. Copper brazing, you see.
Yes. What would they have used the copper for on the planes?
Well, it was induction pipes at that time on Renault engines. But they should have got without them. So nothing to do with them.
So could I ask you now about going to France? What date would that have been when you went over to France?
Well, I didn't like what we were doing in England at the time, and I thought, well, I'm fed up with this. So I asked the Sergeant Major if I could be transferred to an overseas squadron. He says, yes. So it transferred me straight away. And I went to one in, I don't know where that was now, but we was in Beaulieu before we left. We left Beaulieu to go to France. You know Beaulieu in the New Forest. Well, what's his name? That chap is Lord, who was his name? With all the border cars and everybody. Yeah. We went to there, not to this place, but on his roundabout near his estate. And we was training there for a little while. And most of the time there, we had dolphin planes, and they were the fastest plane the fastest plane in the flying corps had in those days. I'm not sure, if they, I think they were 140 miles an hour flying, and they landed at 90, and they could, you know, they couldn't brake them at all to stop them, so there were quite a few accidents with them. Quite a few pilots were killed.
Did you see that yourself?
Oh, yes, I was in it all the time. And then we went to France,
1918, you went to France?
Yes, 20th, I think, of February.
Yes. Would that have been at the time when the Royal Flying Corps was changed over?
Just before. They changed over in April, 1st of April, 1918.
And what did they change over to?
RAF, Royal Air Force.
Yes. What did you think of that?
Nothing.
Did it make any difference to you?
Well, it didn't make a difference at the time, but I wouldn't be in the Air Force.
Why is that?
Well, it's quite different to Flying Corps.
Well, could you tell me the difference between the Flying
Corps? Well, I don't know really how I can explain the difference, because it's in the Flying Corps, we more or less had... I can't say it really, I shouldn't say it really to other people to listen to, because it's more like being at home being in the Flying Corps, but it wasn't in the Air Force, it was too strict. It was quite a different lot of people. And in the Flying Corps, they were more like friends, not army officers and all that sort of thing.
That's interesting. It's
a job to believe it, because unless you were there, you wouldn't know it was right. But we were in the Flying Corps. As I said before, we had quite so many people from abroad, you know, from different countries, officers and all that. And cadets, a lot of cadets. Because if they were cadets and they hadn't passed out, if they passed out on the Flying Corps, they were made officers immediately. Promoted straight away to officers. And they used to do that, so they used to do a lot to the cadets. But I wouldn't be in the Air Force at no price.
Was the turnover very quick of officers? You know, were a lot killed, these flyers?
Well, they used to get killed when they were learning, you know. We've had a few killed during the learning time. But sometimes they go up with an instructor, and then they've got to go after so many hours, they've got to go on their own, whether they like it or not. They've got to go on their own after so long. The instructor won't stay with them too long. They've got other... Well, they don't... It's a reason of nerves, actually, I think, more or less. When they see they're, you know, if they say they're all right, and that they give them a chance to fly the plane while they're in it, the instructor's in it with them, then if he sees it's all right, well then he lets him go on his own and try it. Then that's the time when someone gets killed.
Did you go up at all
in a
plane?
No, I wouldn't go. No.
Right. Well, could I ask you then, Mr. Bates, about, you know, when you went to France? How did you get over to France?
We went over by boat.
Just the Royal Flying Corps?
Oh no, ordinary troops. We went over from Southampton.
How did you get on with the other troops? You know.
Well, we didn't have anything to do with them. And when we went on the boat, it was all... they wouldn't allow you on the deck. We went at night, you see, during darkness. And I would understand that we were chased over there by a German submarine. Or there was one in the vicinity. If we didn't chase, there was one in there. And they wouldn't let us come on deck. It was only two men on deck, one each end of the bloke, lookouts. That's all there was there. You had to go below. If anything happened, you wouldn't have got a chance. You'd have been drowned. But we didn't mix with other people, ever.
So, when you went to France, what was your first stop? You know, your first camp, as it were?
Well, we landed at Le Havre. What it was. Not at Le Havre, and we went from there. We took a squadron, a French squadron, over at Belgium, on the Belgian border. At Saint Marie-Capelle, I don't know if you can read that or not. You can spell that or not if you want to put it down. And we were there on took it over on the other poison gas. We had my gas mask on for 24 hours.
Yes. Could you tell me about that? I didn't quite get what you said. Where did you
experience? We landed at Le Havre, and went to a rest camp for so many hours. And then he moved us up to Belgium border, I think it was, to St. Marie-Capelle, an aerodrome there. And there was poison gas was being sent over then. And we were there the squadron I went with was a 75, must have been, because I was the only one. That was the first one in France. I went out with that one, and I said it was... supposed to have been 440 miles an hour flying, which was the fastest we had. And they gave us to understand that we would be a mobile squadron up and down the line, front and on the line. whatever the worst trouble was with the German planes and that, they would be going down it. But whatever it was, we'd have to go and do it. They would have to go and do it, our pilots. So they were up and down, the bombard squadron up and down the line they were.
Yeah, what was the number of the squadron?
I think the first one in there, 75, wasn't it?
Let me have a...
I think in there, it must have been that one.
Squadron 79.
No, 79
yes,
squadron.
Mobile squadron 79.
Dolphins.
Yes, and you were going to tell me about this gas that you suffered.
Well, we can't say much about it. We took it over. The gas was already coming over when we got there. So we took over in gas masks, you see. And they were shocking gas masks, the first ones we had. They were just like all over your face, you know. And you had to have your nose pinched with a clip. You had to breathe through your mouth, you know. You had to breathe, because there was something on in the mouthpiece to stop the gas coming through. You had to breathe through your mouth. We were like that for nearly 12 hours, and I don't think we could taste for a month after. Our throats were so dry. But that was the end of that. That gas mask attack was quite enough, too. And they moved us, as I said, we were a mobile squadron, and they moved us lower down the line then. I couldn't tell you where we went next time. We weren't anywhere settled at all. We were moving about the whole time. Anyway, I eventually could become sick, and I had to go to report to a doctor, and he sent me to hospital, which you've seen there. I went to the casualty clearing station. He thought I had, well, he didn't tell me, but I had a temperature, and I was in there 10 days. When I came out, they couldn't find my squadron, and where it had gone, so I gave another one. This one here, I think, which one? You've seen this. Oh, 42. The next
42
squadron, 42.
Yes. So what date would that have been when you went
there?
To 42 squadron? This would have been in April, wouldn't it?
Well,
oh, no, May. In May 1918. I was wondering, you see, this gas attack, would that have been at the time of the German advance?
Oh, no, that wasn't until Easter Sunday. It was Easter Sunday that started.
Yes.
Yeah, Parliament, that's right. Yeah.
Yes. So tell
Easter
me...
Easter Sunday they started.
Yes. But before I ask you about that then, tell me about when you went to this other squadron, you know,
well, I didn't
squadron.
Do anything. I think it was a B-2C squadron played, B-2C, I think they were called. And it was an observation squadron, ranging for the artillery, and that's sort of, you know, for ranges and that for the artillery. I think that's what it was. But
what sort of base did you have for that particular squadron? You know, could you tell me about the little airfield and the workshops there?
Well, we didn't have a workshop there. I don't know why they did the work. We didn't have it only 3 miles from the front, you see, from the line. And we just camped there. That's just had the aerodrome there. That's all. The pilots were flying out eventually. You know, whenever they had a word to go, they would go out and come back if they didn't get knocked, if they get shot down. Because many of them got shot down, of course. But otherwise, there was nothing in it, really, in the flying corps in those days. Because it was only in its infancy, wasn't it, the flying corps? It was a balloon squadron before I went in it. It was only balloons. There wasn't no aeroplanes at all.
Was your airfield ever attacked by the enemy?
Well, not that one there wasn't, but... we never had a real attack from the Germans, only on one occasion. And that's called later on again. That's when we returned on the retreat. Better put that in later on.
Yes, I'll ask you about that.
Yes,
because later.
There wasn't much. We did just have a side attack. But as it was in France, it didn't fly good enough to do much. It was the airplanes that did the work. You see, we didn't do the work. We had to keep them going. That's all we were to do, and keep the squadron working.
Did you have a lot of work to do with your welding of the copper?
Well, no, there wasn't much to do. We had the new planes then, we had the rotary engines, and there wasn't a lot of work to do, no work for us at all with the copper work. No induction pipes on rotary engines, because the engine runs down itself.
So what did you do with yourself all day long?
Well, we found something. You could do what they call fatigues, you wanted to get help with the potatoes and do all that sort of thing, and now go down round... helping with everything out that's got to be done. If I had something to do all day long.
Yes, being just 3 miles from the front, as you were...
Well,
with
we were
squadron.
At last at the end, before we retired, before we retreated. I think we were just 3 miles from the front.
Did you hear what was going on at the front?
Well, you could see it at night. See the you can see the flashing and all that at night time, you know. And if you travelled at night, if you're going anywhere at night, travelling at night, you used to be awful travelling at night because all the guns were firing, you know, and you can, whether you're going to hit you or not.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I say, you never knew whether they're going to hit you when you're travelling about like that. But, I don't say, there wasn't a lot to do for the flying corps, but we were there. The pilots were the ones that were the men in the flying corps, not so much the mechanics. We couldn't do much, you see, because we were stationary.
Can you remember any pilot in particular?
Well, not by name now, that's a long time ago. We had the, what was it? I think it was fourth. I think it was six flights to a squadron. A, B, C and D, I believe it was. I'm not quite sure now. And workshop and transport. Of course, I was attached to the workshop, so I didn't see much of the flying at all, of the other parts at all. But the fitters and the riggers that had to do all the work in those days. It's quite different today, you know. There's nothing like it today. Quite a different thing altogether.
Yes, you explained, you know, the sort of family atmosphere about the Royal Flying Corps compared to the RAF.
Yes.
Did you all, was it very democratic? Did you all sort of live together? And
well you had to do that to a certain extent. But, I don't know, something was wrong with the Air Force. I don't know what it was. I don't think anybody liked the Air Force or did the Flying Corps. I might be saying these things I shouldn't do, but that's how we found things out, you see. I think many of them would try to transfer at all. But the big thing was, when they changed to the Air Force in April 1918, they gave me the option of transferring voluntary or going to the infantry, you see. Well, of course, we didn't want to go in the infantry, naturally. So we just let them transfer us automatically. And that's how it came out about that history there.
Yes, why didn't you want to go into the infantry?
Oh, you didn't want to get killed, did you? And you might have got killed either in the flying corps. You didn't know what you were going to do, but I didn't fancy the infantry somehow. Never did fancy it from, you know, my first year.
Did you have any idea what they were going through, the infantry?
Well, we didn't know exactly what we was told, you know, that's all. Because we never saw much because, as I say, we were behind the line and anything that was moving, we didn't see. It was on the roads.
Right. Could I ask you now, then, about the time when you know, the retreat was on, when the Germans pushed forward in your area?
Yeah.
I believe you said this was Easter. Is that right?
Yeah, well, we I don't know how we got, when we moved to a place called Roy, but that was our last aerodrome.
R-O-Y-E.
That was, I think it was only 3 miles. Three miles, not very much, if any more, from St. Quentin, and that's where the fighting was at St. Quentin. We were there, well, I don't think we were there very long, but all the other chaps were doing, we were just going over and bombing, that's all they were doing. Our pilots just going over and bombing. And suddenly one night, I don't know what it was, I was put on a guard that night, and all of a sudden, things were moving up the road. Wholesale. Sergeant Major was, I don't know where he'd been sleeping, but he come out and he said, what's going on? I said, I don't know. I said, something going on here. He said, there's plenty of movement. So he didn't know what to do. I think you can't telephone, you see. You would have to move about, you know, a telephone. If they telephone from there, then not like it is now. You can't switch on the wire now and speak to somebody. Or speak to them without a wire now, can't you? But when I don't know what he said, but he shouldn't run back to where he was, and he packed us up that morning and gave us orders to retreat immediately. So we started retreating. We never got away till night, and that was Palm Sunday. And we got on the road. We didn't retreat in order. We didn't end anyhow. He said, you better get away out of it. He said, we've got no boats to take you back to England. He said, you can get to the coast if you can. He said, and get home. He said, we can't take you back. So we've got no boats in the country at all. No boats in those days, you know. Don't know where they all were. We hadn't done to take us back from France and that. He said, you just take your chance, that's all. Anyhow, it didn't happen that way, luckily. We got on the road, and you know, don't believe me or not, but the French roads, something like these, you know, the wide roads, they were transport and moving four deep going down the coast. Four. You couldn't move, no room on the road at all. I was going four deep. But I was walking down the road and looks at me, hey, you want a lift? And a lorry, I said, no, I said, I can do it anyway. So he said, look. Well, before that, we'd been starting the road walking, you know, and Joan was bumping us the whole time. He was bumping that road as fast as he could. We'd never hit it. Couldn't get it once. His bombs used to drop in the field, both sides, luckily. So when we saw him coming over, we just tucked it in the side of the edge, side of the field, you know. And the bombers and missiles would go over the field there. And anyway, got going. And the other thing about it was, they were bombing us there with our own planes, the Germans. Not all of them, but they were quite some of our own. That's why we didn't worry a lot. We thought it was our own planes flying over, looking at, helping us out. They were looking after us. And it was German trains, Germans in our plane bombing us. Anyway, I think, I don't know what they were. I forget what those planes were called. Did he have one as well? I'm not quite sure. Anyhow, we got on the road and he stepped to pick me up. He said, hey, you better carry up. He said, you can't keep walking on the road like that. He said, so I got in there and going along, kept bombing. Never stopped bombing the Germans that night. Anyway, we got to Amiens, and when we got there, the town was absolutely crowded, but blocked full with transport. You couldn't get through. So they took us through. With the lorry, I don't know anymore, but the lorry I was on, he went down the side road, down past the railway, and that was all absolutely on fire. They hit a ammunition train there, bombers had, set it on fire, it was shocking. Things were flying all over the place. So anyway, I fell asleep then. been down there asleep a few days. So I fell asleep on the front with him, on the front, and eventually he called me, he said, God, you'd better get up now, so we're not going any further. But they stopped us in the end. I don't know whether it was our squad, I know it was our squad and commander, but someone stopped the transport and told all the Air Force to get out. So we got a place called Chokes this time, Chokues, if you want to put it down, Chokues. It was a French aerodrome, and we stopped there, and the place was absolutely full of hell holes and goodness knows what. So anyway, that's the place where we were warned about the Germans. We had a warning to say, give us all guns, revolvers. And they warned us that there's two Germans on the loose. They said they're heading this way, but we never saw them. Never came to our aerodrome. And then we had, I think a German plane landed, but he was quite very quiet. He never did cause any trouble. Landed and took him prisoner. So that was all there was at Chokes. And I don't know how long I was there. I was there a few weeks, and there was nothing for me to do, so I was on the telephone exchange there, taking war messages, you know, from the commanders and that, for so long. Eventually, they came to me and said, pack your stuff. He said, and report the order room. So I went down there, so he said, you went home. I said, oh, thanks a lot for that. I'll come back. I had a special job, but it never materialised because the war finished. That was hard. That was from Morden's, wasn't it?
Yes. Could you tell me about that?
Well, I don't know any why I heard myself. It was only the Scots, some of the Scots regiments. You know, this is how I heard it, but I don't want it to be, you know, to get me in any trouble, but this is how I heard it when we got to France. This is the beginning of the war, of course. Mons, that was. That was in the retreat from Mons. And the Germans were ill-treating the Scots because they were wearing skirts, wearing kilts. Thought they were women, you see. That's what we heard. So when they were taking these prisoners down, so they marched, and then we used to give them a lift to the Germans, make them walk to the rest, to the camps, and the war camps. And we're marching down this day, and some of the Scots said, we'll see to them, leave them, we'll take them down, shut them up. Didn't take any at all, they shot all the Germans. That's all we heard, I don't know. But we never had any near our place. We never saw any prisoners, because I say we were off the road, you see, being in flying corn. We don't want planes on roads.
Yes, could I ask, you know, when you retreated from your airfield,
yes.
Did you have to leave a lot of stuff behind?
Left everything. And, you know, when we retreated, we had to leave everything. We just flew the planes away as they were. If I left my steel helmet behind for one thing, which I really wanted. And we hadn't got a few miles away when the sergeant came along and he said, I want four volunteers, you, and you. That's how they volunteer, you know, in the army. You don't get a chance to volunteer, they say, you. and that we sent us back to the aerodrome that we'd just left, the French one. They told you what we left behind. He said, load that roughly tender up with the propellers, and then much oil and petrol as you can. Well, we got there, we could hear the German across the other side of the aerodrome. Mind you, the aerodrome's a big place, you know. It's not only a few yards, it's a big place. And we could see them now and again, you know, over there, and they were firing. So we didn't know what to do. Only four of us were back, so we didn't know what to do, so decided, oh, we'll burn the blooming aerodrome down, and frig on. We've got plenty of petrol. We couldn't get it all on the tender anyway to take back. So we started putting petrol on the hangars and trying to burn. They wouldn't burn. They were fireproof. So we did, left them. We just dodged behind the tent, behind the hangars again, and got on the tender and left it. And on the way there, of course, we didn't know much about it. And on the way there from where we were, where we told us to go back there for the propellers, the police kept pulling us up and said, "Where are you going?" So we went so on. So we said, "You're doing a damn silly thing, you know." He said, "The Germans are advancing fast." So anyway, he said, "You take your own risk. Travis are all right, so I'll take it." He said, "He got us back all right."
Well, was it chaotic, though, that ritual?
Well, we weren't amongst the army, you see, so we don't know a lot about that.
You didn't see anything?
Not too much, you know. We saw plenty of retreating, and not so much of the army, but people, civilians, French people, getting their way out of it as soon as they could, because the Germans are advancing so fast. Donkeys and carts and all sorts of things, getting the belongings back, what they could. And that's all we saw, that really, because I say we weren't with the army, you see.